Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of October. Monday at 9 is All Things Political. And we have much to discuss this first hour of the program. David Winston is our guest this hour. David joins us fairly often to talk about a number of political issues. He is the president and the founder of the Winston Group, which is a survey research firm, and they look at audience motivation. And he has been doing a lot of things in Washington. He has served as senior leadership staff in Congress and a senior fellow to a prominent Washington, D.C. think tank. He spent 4 years working with former House Republican Conference Chair J.C. Watts. He was director of planning for the Speaker of the House, where he oversaw initiatives ranging from education, taxes, Social Security, health care, and technology to the 21st Century Congress. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He also has been working on an international level with the European Ideas Network, a public policy think tank that works with politicians and strategists from the center-right parties of the European Parliament. And he has been teaching, an adjunct professor of communications at American University. He's lectured at a number of universities. He teaches campaign strategy at the Campaign Management Institute at American University, is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. He wrote a very interesting piece on SCHIP last week, and we will talk about that, of course, during the course of this hour. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. He served as chief information officer for the Republican National Committee under four chair, beginning with the late Lee Atwater. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. For you to join our All Things Political for this Monday. Hello, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay, doing well.
Good. It's hot, though. Is it hot there? Man, it's just like 90 degrees, and it's like I went swimming outside yesterday.
No, it's been pretty bad here. I mean, for the beginning of October, actually up in Wisconsin, that's really unusual.
Yeah.
But, D.C., normally it stays a little warmer later, but it was pretty unpleasant yesterday.
Yeah. Very, very strange weather. Well, let's start with the front runners here. We'll get into SCHIP because I was interested in your article, but we'll get into that in a few moments. Do we see a solidification now of support for Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton?
More so for Hillary Clinton than Rudy Giuliani. I think you've seen her begin to pull away, and she has a pretty sizable lead. It's going to be up to Obama to sort of change the political equilibrium in the on the Democratic side, if he's going to figure out some way to break through. Because if he doesn't, I think she probably wins. If she wins Iowa, it's basically all over, because there's no other place to really stop her. On the Republican side, Giuliani has solidified a lead. The question is whether that lead is large enough for him to win. If everything held the way it is, he'd barely probably pull it off, but you've got some other, Romney's looking at Iowa and New Hampshire, sort of winning those two, seeing if he could sort of slingshot himself into leading. If Thompson were to win in South Carolina, or oddly enough, McCain in New Hampshire, that could change the dynamic. He's got a lead, but it's a lot tighter race on the Republican side.
Yeah. There are indications, and tell me what you think of this, that Giuliani is the only Republican who could beat Clinton, and he could do that.
I think some of the others are competitive. He does the best out of the group, but even he's down by 7 or 8 points at this point. She's had a pretty good month here.
Yeah, I think you're right.
and she's done pretty well. She's opened that gap. I mean, Giuliani and McCain, interesting enough, had trailed, but had been by, you know, within margin of error, and now she's opened that up, so that's beyond margin of error. And so she's got a pretty sizable lead. If election were held today, she'd be president.
Mm-hmm. What about this meeting of evangelical leaders in Salt Lake City within the last week to talk about abandoning the Republicans and forming a third party, which I'm sure would thrill the Democrats? Is that just a lot of talk?
Hard to tell at this point. I mean, I think there was a sense amongst some of those individuals, not necessarily the groups, but the individuals, that they could pretty much, at least on the social side, shape who the candidate was going to be. Obviously, that Giuliani, in terms of his positions on gay rights and abortion, are quite different from them. But what saw out there was some sense of how do we politically deal with the fact that there's a very good chance the Republican candidate is not going to agree with us. It's a little bit of cutting off your nose to spite your face. I mean, it's sort of like Nader in 2000. I mean, if they put somebody up, then that just makes it that much more likely that Hillary Clinton will get elected, which is, again, the sort of difficulty that they find themselves in.
Right. Why is it, David, that evangelicals have not embraced any of the candidates? There are candidates there who would fall in line with a lot of their values, aren't there?
Yeah, I think it's one of these things where there's no clear individual. There's no reason why they would all group to one person. I mean, I can't philosophically, they're not going to be too far from Thompson or McCain, although they were irritated about McCain in terms of immigration. Romney, they have some concerns about, although he sort of ideologically comes in line. And actually, in some cases, among those social conservatives where terrorism is their number one issue, Giuliani is somebody who they could be comfortable with. I think the group out in we were just talking about may view this group as a little monolithic and a little dogmatic, and I don't think that they are that way.
Yeah. And tell me why you think Hillary is really moving ahead.
She has begun to lay out a clear direction. She's laying out some pieces of her agenda pretty aggressively, healthcare being the most obvious one. Obama was able to engage the electorate in a really pretty remarkable way. I mean, even if he finishes second here, no one should underestimate the really remarkable achievement that he was able to pull off here in terms of virtually coming out of nowhere and being a serious competitor here. But what he hasn't been able to do, he sort of engaged her at a personality level, sort of at a resume level, in the sense of what his background is. But he hasn't gotten to the sort of issues, policy side of it. And right now, she's showing a sort of distinct advantage there. And I think that's where you're beginning to see that separation. Mm-hmm. He's got to figure out some way to engage at that level.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about, which I've never fully understood. Tell me about the animosity felt toward Hillary Clinton by some in the Republican Party, probably a number of those Christian conservatives we were talking about earlier. Will they rally to the polls to vote for whoever the Republican candidate is simply because she's disliked so much? And I also want to ask you about the source of that dislike.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the best way to say it, again, rightly or wrongly, is again, when you look at some of the Democratic base and their attitude toward George Bush, I mean, just sort of invert that in terms of how there are some Republicans that just feel that way about her and her husband. It goes back, again, to the 90s in the sense of there were just some Republicans who are very frustrated, and you saw that sort of get played out in a variety of different ways, the impeachment being one.
Mm-hmm. S-CHIP, let's talk about S-CHIP for a while. You wrote an interesting column in Roll Call last week about this. What the country and certainly poor children don't need is the leadership of the majority party trying to score political points, and I think you're right, they are scoring points with this, by exploiting the health care vulnerabilities of low-income children, as they did with the school lunch program appropriations a decade ago. What are the problems, do you think, with S-CHIP? Why do you think the president, obviously a lot of people in his party voted in favor of this, and certainly the Democrats did, and I think they're going to use it to their advantage during the campaign. What problems do you have with S-CHIP?
Well, the biggest problem, actually, I think Wisconsin is one of the states that really uses S-CHIP almost, I think, predominantly for adults. And so the biggest problem I had with it, I think 13% of the dollars spent on S-CHIP are spent on adults, not actually children. And so one of the things that I was advocating was that if Republicans were going to engage in this debate, they needed to at least take out a position that was sort of defendable in the sense of, you know, otherwise you'd look like you're just against children, which, of course, is not the position.
Right. Again.
So at least what I was advocating in that piece was, okay, if you're going to take this position, just simply say you're going to insure all children, either who don't have insurance, not those who do, or who are over 18. What the Democrats passed was, in fact, a dynamic where you were insuring adults and you were insuring a lot of those who already presently have insurance. And so that's what I was trying to let. But they were sort of trying to do the wide swath to catch, make sure everybody got caught, and I was sort of arguing trying to be more specific. Having said that, you've seen the president try to do that. His line is poor gets first. The dynamic there, though, is it may that positioning may have come too late in order not to be able to reshape the argument.
Right. So the Democrats will use this politically and will win with it politically.
Well, if Republicans are not successful in reshaping the argument in terms of how I described, otherwise what the Democrats are basically saying is Republicans don't want to insure kids. And if that side of it, if the Republicans are ineffective in laying out what they actually did, that'll be a pretty difficult position to sustain.
Yeah. Let's talk about the philosophy here of health care. Is there a substantial difference, do you think, between the Republican candidates who are running for president and the Democratic candidates who are running for president when it comes to what they would do to fix the ailing system?
Yeah, this is perhaps an area where you do see sort of the classic difference between the two parties, I think, here. Democrats want to engage government a lot more to make sure that people who don't have health care get it, and to some degree, even those who do get it, that how they receive it is somewhat monitored. Hillary Clinton was very careful to sort of define sort of patient-focused health care, was the way she described it, not going to where she went in 94. Whereas Republicans sort of see it as a public-private partnership, but want to keep it more so on the private side than the public side, assuming that the quality and sustain quality better that way. And ultimately, if the private side is given some flexibility, they can cover more people. I mean, this is really a classic fight, a difference between the two parties at a broader level being played out in one specific issue.
Do you think that the Republicans are behind the game here and not offering fairly complete plans? It's my feeling, just from doing a lot of talk shows on this topic, and I'm sure yours as well, because you've worked in healthcare in the government, that everybody's concerned about this. Republicans, Democrats, businesses, people who are uninsured, that number keeps going up. That we got to do something in this country, and the more plans we have to look at, the better.
Well, let's start off with the basic demographic, and that is, first off, the group that uses health care most are older individuals. Well, as the baby boomer bubble hits retirement, that just shows the amount of people engaged in the health care system is going to increase. That's the first thing. The second thing is because we've been able to cure certain diseases and our health quality of our health care has got better, we're all living longer. So the older population is growing and living longer, so the demand on the health care system is going to be pretty significant. Part of the problem that Republicans have is they haven't really, and so as a result, you're seeing the issue increase in terms of level of concern. And also you've got, again, costs on a variety of different levels because people are dealing with so many additional costs, gas prices, property taxes, college tuition, and health care. Health care is obviously a much more immediate cost. I mean, you have to get your prescription drugs, you have to go see your doctor. Republicans haven't really effectively engaged in this issue. They've sort of focused on other issues. And so when you look at issue handling, which party had more confidence to handle the issue of health care, Republicans trailed by as much as 20 points. And so one of the problems that Republicans have as a party is they're trying to engage in an issue where the public has given a very significant edge to the Democrats.
Right. So what does that do for the Republicans in this go-around, considering that this is probably issue number two?
I'd say it's number three. You've got Iraq terrorism, you've got the economy, and then you've got health care. I mean, what it is Republicans are going to have to start thinking up some creative ways to sort of deal with a variety of different problems dealing with health care and really engage. And they've got to engage in an environment where the public doesn't necessarily view them as the solution to that particular issue. And so it's a pretty big challenge. Now, having said that, Republicans were able to do that in the issue of education back in around 2000, 2001, and it was one of the reasons why Bush got elected. But it took a pretty focused effort by a presidential candidate. And at this point, maybe outside of Romney, I'm not sure that there's one who has had that level of focus on health care prior to this campaign.
Right. Do you have a favorite now, David, or not?
No, I'm still neutral. I mean, I... I think the field is a pretty good field. It represents sort of a broad range. I think there are a lot of people who are pretty surprised that Giuliani has managed to sustain a lead given his social positions. But I think that shows the strength on the sort of terrorism side. Thompson has been an interesting entry into the race. I think we're going to find out in the debate this week just what he's made of. And I think it's been interesting that McCain has managed to, he obviously fell back, but has managed to sort of stay in the middle of this. I think it's a good field on our side. It's at this point a little, it's been sort of overshadowed in terms of the press because you've had these two unique individuals on the Democratic side in terms of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, first woman, first African American.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly created some intensity on the Democratic side and from the media. But I think at this point, looking at our side, the problem isn't necessarily the individual candidates. And to some degree, it's going to be they've got to start articulating some positions and not sort of reiterating their resume as well.
David Winston is our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political. You hear Mondays at 9 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, and David joins us fairly frequently to talk about political kinds of issues. He is president of the Winston Group and survey research firm, and he has he's done all kinds of work. He's worked with political campaigns, many political campaigns, served as senior leadership staff in Congress. He also was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He has worked with the European Ideas Network, has taught at American University, MIT, Georgetown, William & Mary, George Washington, and he is now teaching campaign strategy at the Campaign Management Institute at American University. Also is a columnist for the Capitol Hill newspaper, Roll Call. Take on any political subject you'd like this hour. We, of course, are looking at the presidential race. We are talking about health care and the S-CHIP program. We have yet to talk about Iraq, which is unusual for us. We'll get to that in a moment. And whatever else you would like to put on the table as we talk politics. Oh, yeah, we have an email address, too, and that is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston is our guest. It's All Things Political, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. If it's in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. As we focus mostly on the presidential race, do you see any big news in the fact that polls from last week show that Mayor Giuliani is the front runner among the Republican candidates, that Hillary Clinton has really solidified her lead, and the latest poll from Iowa shows that she is ahead now in the state of Iowa? What about Christian conservatives being unhappy with the field? Do you think they might form a third party? I'm sure the Democrats would be very happy about that. What about S-CHIP and the president vetoing that legislation? What about health care? Do the Democrats, is this a huge issue for you? Do the Democrats present more than the Republicans? Is it a liability for the Republicans that they haven't presented very firm plans? And we'll be talking about, well, whatever you want to bring up on All Things Political, starting with Jim from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. My purpose of my call today is to encourage people to read Dr. Justin Frank's book, Bush on the Couch, to get some perspective of his views on torture. And it would seem, just on the basis of logic, that simulated drownings and, of course, exposing people to extreme cold would constitute torture. On page 105 of the book, the author talks about Bush's experience of initiating pledges into the fraternity by putting a hot tip of a wire coat hanger on the buttocks of the initiates, and denying that this was a torture, and that saying it was only a cigarette burn and it didn't leave a scar. And earlier in the book, in specifically in pages 40 to 41 for the audience, he talks about how Bush, in his estimation, and is in mine too, because I did 9 years of treatment in the prison system for alcoholism, that Bush basically admits that he was an alcoholic, but he doesn't say that he doesn't do the 12 steps or the admit that go to AA. And he talks about the fact that you can be sober, but that doesn't mean that your underlying deficiencies in thinking are addressed, and that people alcoholics have to learn how to handle their anxieties and how they have to learn how to not project them on other people and avoid the rigidity in the thinking that leads to bad decisions in life. And so that if you don't, you can abstain from drinking, but if you don't treat the underlying ism, that you're going to have problems in managing your life. And the public should look at this book very carefully because this affects how he operates the presidency.
David.
Not being obviously familiar with this particular book, I think he described having to sort of manage a lot of things in his personal life, and I'm not actually particularly familiar how he described his alcoholism. I think in terms of torture, I think one of the things that has been difficult to sort of lay out, and it's obviously been controversial, but again, for the first time, we're sort of like writing this down as a policy. Has been the process that the government and this administration has been forced to sort of lay out. And what I mean by forced is this had not been in place, laying out exactly what we define as torture and what we don't. And obviously, there's been quite a lot of disagreement as we sort of work this out, and that's obviously been a huge level of controversy. I'm not sure that I would necessarily tie the two together the way that author did. You can disagree with what his interpretation of torture is. I'm not sure that it came through the way the author laid out his particular argument here.
What did you make of the Blackwater hearings last week, David?
Depressing. Let's just start right there. I mean, it was I guess at a personal level, I have to say I'm not sure I understand why, if we have all the military over there, why you needed sort of private security folks engaged. Obviously, somebody made that decision, and they need to be held accountable. And clearly, at least at this point, until it broke, that process for if they did something like they are accused of doing, there didn't seem to be a particular avenue to make sure that there was accountability.
So you would be just as happy to have those private security firms not there to have the military handle their responsibilities?
Well, again, it depends. Where you're using firearms at the level they apparently were, that obviously indicates more of a security military situation than just a security, you know, crime situation. But at this point, if you're going to engage those individuals, you have to be able to hold them accountable. But it seems like there was an awful lot of firearm situation,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to indicate more of a military situation than just a security situation.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Let's go next to Ed is next from Menominee. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Hi.
We're talking about the S-chip and the recent veto, and David was saying he was concerned with so many adults being, the ones utilizing the increase there. And I get confused when we start to talk about health care. I mean, we're a unique country, the only modern nation without some form of universal health care. At what point do we start to, not that children aren't important, but these are the families of these children. At what point do we stop valuing adults, adult life? I mean, life is life. We have 47 million Americans with no health insurance. 37 million on a low count living in poverty. I mean, I'm just not sure of what this mentality is.
Well, going direct to your point, if that's what the debate's about in terms of how do we get universal coverage and how do we have the government create universal coverage, then the Democrats should say that. But if you've noticed in terms of their arguments, they've specifically said they're not doing that. Right? And so, part of this debate is again positioning on the Democrats to get this program through at the level they want, doing certain things that they want, and Republicans trying not to move to government sort of universal health care. Everybody's for everybody getting covered. The question is how do you get there? Again, I think you see the Democrats sort of leaning more in terms of the government direction. The Republicans leaning more on the private sector. You can argue which one is more effective, but I think around this debate, the Democrats have not said that they, in fact, intend to cover adults, and have sort of tried to keep that quiet. Although I think this is the move to sort of move toward government universal health care.
Well, you know, this debate, as you well know, David, has been around for years and years. And it seems to me as though people on both sides of the aisle here want people covered. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with people having health insurance or people being able to pay for it. And it seems as though it's another instance of Congress getting caught up in a philosophical debate or a nitpick kind of debate and ignoring the real issue here. And I don't think a lot of people understand why that's the case and why it's gone on for so many years.
No, and I have to say, in this particular situation, that the ideology of both parties, I would actually agree with you, that the ideology of both parties here has gotten away of potentially moving towards some solutions. I mean the idea that poor children who can't afford their health care shouldn't get covered, I think you'd find most Republicans are for, but in the nature of the way this particular bill evolved, I think there's some discomfort. Just to give one example of a Republican health care idea, okay, thank you for the moment of propaganda, is something like small business health plans, where you allow small businesses to pull together to be able to provide health insurance for their employees. This would take probably about 1 million to 2 million people off the uninsured rolls. Certainly not, you know, the large numbers, but at least a step in the right direction. That got stopped as well. And again, I think that was an ideological dynamic as much as anything else in terms of the Democrats filibustering that when we had the majority. So this ideological conflict sometimes does get in the way of solutions here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to David next from Appleton. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Morning, David.
Say, I'm calling about Iraq and the war in Iraq, and I was just hoping to get a sense from Mr. Winston about I think it was the last or the second to last Democratic debate, there was an attempt to nail down the candidates about a definite date or, you know, when you're elected, a year later, will all the troops be out of Iraq? And to connect that with the thought that, or the question about whether or not people's, Democrats in particular, feelings about withdrawing, wanting to get out of Iraq, end the war, and whether the relationship to that, just with respect to their anger over how and why we got into the war in Iraq, and whether or not we're right in terms of what we're doing there now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going. Let me parse that out a couple of different ways. I mean, first off, if there's a clear difference in terms of the two primaries, the direction the Democratic primary debate's going is very much how do we get out of the war as quickly as we can, whereas on the Republican side, it's still how do we sort of manage this situation and see if there's some opportunity for actually being able to succeed in Iraq. That's not implying that the Democrats don't want to succeed. I think they've sort of viewed it at this point that we've sort of gone beyond the pale there, and the Republicans don't agree with that. Having said that, I think in this last debate, what was interesting was that all the three major Democratic candidates, Edwards, Obama, and Clinton, basically said that they couldn't get all the troops out by the time their first term would be over. I think that came as quite a surprise to a lot of people. But I don't think that should take away from the fact that there's that clear focus. Part of the problem that you have with the American public right now, problem is not the right word, part of the dynamic with the American public right now is they don't see an international strategy. What happens in Iraq and what happens in the United States doesn't seem to be connected to that. If that connection is not there, then there's no international strategy to fight that. And so if there's no international strategy, what's the point of the war in Iraq? And I think that's what it's been incumbent upon this president to sort of lay out that he has not done. And I think that's one of the reasons why people don't understand the war, because they don't see the international strategy. And as a result of that, they're just as soon like to get out now. I think Republican candidates also, it's incumbent upon them, if they're going to pursue a more aggressive policy that they've got to lay out, how does that fit into some overall international strategy?
Anything else, David?
Nope.
All right, thank you.
No, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for your call. We go next to Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to the early part of your program where you were discussing the Republican candidates, And I was a little disappointed that you didn't mention Ron Paul.
Yeah, I knew you were going to, Matt. I knew you were going to call.
Since he's had such a stellar performance, and he's moving his campaign forward with a 50% or more increase in his contributions, while all the rest of the Republican candidates were moving backwards, getting less contributions than they got in the second quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And like when you look at John McCain, he took in a similar amount of money as Ron Paul, yet his money's all gone. He's still broke because he spent it as fast as he could get it, while Ron Paul's got his money on hand and is still growing his campaign. And if I can say one last thing, I campaigned door-to-door for Ron Paul this weekend, and just since the announcement of his $5 million in contributions, his name recognition has gone through the roof in a week.
David.
Well, a couple of things. First off, I think that the $5 million for Ron Paul was a pretty surprising number to a lot of people. I think that sort of continues to sort of to sort of feed his campaign in a positive direction, and the fact that he outraised Huckabee, who everybody thought had sort of emerged out of the sort of Iowa straw poll as potentially the one in the second tier to sort of move up, and he only raised $1 million. The Ron Paul candidacy is an interesting candidacy. He's still, in terms of when you look at any of these polls, in terms of either the states or the national level, has not had a breakthrough moment. Maybe he can use this $5 million to sort of translate into some sort of breakthrough. I think it's probably unlikely. But if his attempt, if his goal was to sort of potentially impact things a bit, he's certainly done that. I think he's still a remarkable long shot at this point.
What he has, as Matt will attest to this, because Matt is an ardent supporter, he does have this very loyal group of supporters. You see more Ron Paul bumper stickers, I think, than anybody else right now.
No, because there's a group of people that he is clearly connected with who really like him, and they've really engaged with him. The challenge to Ron Paul is how does he grow outside that circle? And while additional resources will do that. I mean, the fact is he's gotten a lot of publicity prior to getting those resources, and he really hasn't grown that much. I mean, he's picked up some, but nowhere near what you need to begin to even engage the first level tier candidate.
Right. We'll take more phone calls. Our number is 800, and lines are open. If you've been sitting around waiting for a phone line to open, don't sit around anymore because they're open right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And we also have this high-tech email system, so I can see these emails that you write, but you haven't written any, so I can't see them yet. If you would like to send us an email for our All Things Political segment, please just send it to talk@wpr.org. We're talking about healthcare, which has been very much in the news. We're talking about the, at the moment at least, this is subject to change, the front runners, how Senator Hillary Clinton is solidifying a lead, and the poll last week from Iowa showing she is ahead in that state right now. David's saying that she has to win that state, and we'll look at why she is moving ahead. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani is ahead in national polls right now as well, but there is still some dissatisfaction with him, and we're going to look more with you, actually, at the Republican field here. We're talking about Iraq. We're talking about all things political. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Winston, president of the Winston Group, is our guest this hour as we talk all things political. 800-486-8655. The firm that he is with has – they do all kinds of things. They do survey research firms. So they look at audience motivation and have an individualized approach to meet needs of each individual client. He has done a lot of work with political campaigns, has served as four-year tenure working with former House Republican Conference Chair J.C. Watts. He was director of planning for the Speaker of the House, where he did a lot of work in the areas of education, taxes, Social Security, healthcare, and technology. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He taught in a number of places, and he teaches at American University Campaign Management Institute. He's done election analysis for Voter News Service and also for CBS News, and has written and spoken extensively on all things political. 800-486-8655. Scott from Madison is our next caller, David. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning to you both. A couple weeks ago, right after Hillary released her health care proposal, I read a column by or an opinion piece by a guy named Nestleway. His last name is, he's syndicated by Cox Newspapers. And in that opinion piece, he stated that the Bush administration plans to offer its own universal care proposal with a plan to have this in place before he leaves office. And he said the goals were as follows. If Bush could get it passed, it's his legacy, you know, along with Iraq, of course. If he can't get it passed, then what he puts the Democrats in a position of is having to vote against some kind of a universal health care proposal. And it also, if it does become fait accompli, it takes health care off the table as a Democrat issue for the next election.
And the details of the plan are what? How would he implement this?
Well, this column did not go into that. What this is a guy, I think he's writing out of Waco. He's syndicated by Cox, and they picked it up in the Madison newspaper here, and it just said, you know, interest in universal health care is universal. And it said that actually if Bush proposes such a thing, he said probably the heaviest listing is going to be among the Republican Congress members to try and get them to pass it. But it's definitely going to be a goal for before he leaves office. And, you know, as I read it, I was thinking, oh, yeah, next State of the Union, he comes out with this as his centerpiece and says, you know, this is what I want to get done. And I'm assuming it would be some version of universal care without, as Mr. Winston there stated, without a lot of government control on it. But still in all, something that they would call universal care.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that. Have you, David?
Did a proposal, which is I think maybe what the writer was referencing, did a proposal in the spring moving toward having a lot more people get covered. It was a private-public sort of partnership concept. The bigger problem for Bush at this point is it's after immigration sort of fell through, it's going to be very hard for him to engage in any initiatives. It takes a long time to really come up with a new idea and sort of drive it. I mean, that's typically what campaigns are used for. Bush used No Child Left Behind, the discussion around that in the 2000 election to sort of drive that particular debate in terms of education. At this point, with a year and a half to go, with Iraq being so central, it's just and immigration having been his previous, it's just really hard for him at this point to assert a new agenda item. Unless he's got some specific control, the best one being, and I think you'll probably see this, is he'll really engage on the issue of spending, and you'll probably see some vetoes around some spending bills. If I can, I want to go back, Kathleen, to one point that you made before, just so the audience is clear. I don't think Hillary Clinton has to win Iowa. I think if she wins Iowa, it's all over. If she doesn't win
Iowa, you're right, yeah.
If she doesn't win Iowa, I still think she's got a huge lead, and I think she'll be able to weather that and will still likely win. It's just if she wins Iowa, it is all over at that point.
Yeah, and the poll last week shows she's ahead in Iowa now too. That wasn't the case.
No, and she had opened up that lead into double digits. And again, for Edwards and Obama, if she wins it really is pretty much over. The problem that I mean, Edwards is focusing specifically on Iowa. If he doesn't win there, then he's pretty much out.
Right.
What Obama's got to figure out is that if he doesn't win in Iowa, what's the state that he wins? And oddly enough, and maybe South Carolina is the big opportunity there because the percentage of the Democratic primary vote being African-American is pretty significant. But you've also seen in polls where she and he have been actually splitting the African-American vote, so it's not clear that going to a state that has a large African-American population that he gets a win either. So his problem is, where do I actually get my first win?
Yeah. He's organizing the hairstylists in South Carolina. That seems to me to be a unique strategy.
Well, remember, no, well, wait, Hillary Clinton did a whole big presentation to a hairstylist convention, if I'm not mistaken.
Did she really?
Yeah, no, no. What it is, you know, just as you might have, you know, gas station business owners, right? I mean, that there's a group of individuals. I mean, those are a lot of small businesses, hairstyling small businesses. Apparently there are enough of them that this is a constituency, so they've both talked to him.
Right, right. I think it's a great idea. You talk about, because you see your hair done and you talk. You talk politics, you talk gossip, you're sitting there, your captive audience, for an hour.
Well, again, to emphasize, yeah, they may be hairstylists, but a lot of them are also small business owners, too.
Right,
So it depends which lens you look at them through.
Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. Let's go next to... Judy is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't have my radio on, but I can hear. At any rate, Why do I hear myself talk? I don't have the radio on.
You're hearing yourself talk? Maybe because you're talking.
I hear this echo.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry, Judy. Just carry on, though.
Okay. I'd like to say I am not against the profit motive, but I would like to have a question answered by the Republican. Why do they say the profit motive for health care is more efficient when Medicare is about the most efficient health care we can have? And yet, when we have in the private sector, the bills go up, the prices go up, the pills go up, everything becomes more expensive because they're making a profit.
David?
Well, I would argue that's not necessary just the profit motive. I mean, you've had liability has dramatically increased, which has increased the cost of healthcare sort of across the board. What you're also beginning to see is the quality of the healthcare in America is not the debatable item. It's the access to that's the dynamic. When you've got 40 million or 47 million people who are uninsured, The problem isn't the quality, it's the access to that quality, or with cost obviously being the barrier. And so the problem is not how do we create better health care, because the quality is there. It's how do we make sure that everybody gets access to it, and that's the problem that's facing the country. The concern is that if you go to other universal government systems, that you have huge waiting periods. I mean, you've seen situations in England where someone gets diagnosed for breast cancer and then has to wait, 4 to 6 months before anything is done about that. I think in this country that would be an intolerable wait. So the question is, how do you get to a greater level of coverage without impacting that quality of health care?
But she makes a point, and I think it's a valid point, David, that there are some public plans that seem to work pretty well. There are problems with Medicare, but on the whole, people really like Medicare, and it is very much a government-run program. You have the Veterans Administration with vets accessing that, and they have for years in this country some problems with it, but, you know, on the whole, not a bad program. You've got the program that everybody in Congress has, government-run program, top-line benefits. Everybody's happy with that as well. So we have some programs that have some government involvement that are okay.
No, and I don't think talking to Republicans like you are at the moment, I don't think there's any sense that the concept of a public-private partnership is fine. I think where you see the concern here is where it becomes much more dominant on just the public-run side of it, where things become more complicated. And on the Republican side, again, in terms of that private-public relationship, that the private ends
right.
up being a little, and so I think you see that there's a nuance in terms of who sort of has the greater say. Now, having said that, unfortunately, what happens in D.C. is that particular argument becomes ideological first, in which case people just sort of dig in.
Right,
and,
right,
right.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. And do you think that as you look at the Democratic plans, are you worried that some of them are too much government run? There's too much government involvement.
I think looking at Edwards, the answer to that would be clearly yes. I've read a little bit about Hillary Clinton's plan, and I have to say I don't know enough about it. I think she went to great lengths to differentiate what she's doing now from what you did in 94, and I thought the interesting phrase was the concept of patient-focused health care, which obviously the last time around was government deciding who your doctor was going to be, right, the line against her plan. That shift suggests that she's thought through in terms of clearly understanding she can't make it all government-run. I have not had a chance to look through it in level and depth to sort of understand how that line falls between public and private. But you're watching her being somewhat sensitive to that particular argument.
Right. Thanks, Judy, very much for the call. Let's go to Louise next from Eagle. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I'm calling because of the polls, and sometimes the news media I'm frustrated with both. The reason is it kind of is telling us who's going to win or who's out ahead, and it discourages, I think, a lot of people from going to vote when they think their candidate doesn't even have a chance. I think if we didn't have the polls, we'd get more people to the voting booths because they wouldn't have this hopeless feeling, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's kind of like telling us that the economy's horrible, so nobody goes and spends any money and makes it worse.
David?
The polling is, at least in terms of public polling by the networks, is going to be a part of the political process because to some degree the news entities have got to give people the sense of how is this political race evolving and giving people some sense of that. And yes, there is obviously the part if you're supporting a second-tier candidate, it's pretty depressing on a daily basis to sort of hear how poorly your candidate is doing. But the polls do pretty much accurately reflect where the public's at. And I would also suggest that actually turnout's been higher. If you look from 2000 to 2004, the presidential turnout actually increased 20% in terms of the general election. But the one thing the polls tell you and what's interesting about them is that it shows you what candidates need to do to be able to succeed. And so you have some sense of what to look for. Again, going back to Obama and Hillary Clinton, I mean, there's an equilibrium that sort of evolved on the Democratic side, and it's up to Obama to change that equilibrium because Hillary Clinton wants to keep it the way it is. Same thing for the second-tier candidates. I mean, you saw Huckabee sort of have this chance and not necessarily translate that into moving into the first tier.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the same thing with Edwards in terms of how does he actually sort of evolve a campaign and really get into competition with Obama and Clinton. It lays out where the situation is, so you sort of have an understanding as sort of an American watching the process. If you're for one person and they're, like, way down the list, you know, if you're for Joe Biden, this has probably been sort of frustrating.
Thanks so much for the call. Pat from Prairie du Chien is next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just wondered, about a month ago, do you remember there was this Israeli attack on Syria? And since then, it's dropped off the radar. No one wants to talk about it. I wonder if your guest had any comment on that.
And now I'm going to really frustrate the caller. I'm not sure that I'm particularly familiar with that either. I mean, the one thing that I think the caller does represent is because of Iraq, just the national focus on Israel and the Middle East, which has occurred since 2001. I mean, that is something that is different from the end of last century versus this century, the level of focus on what's going on in the Middle East and sort of sensitivity to anything that happens there. Is a significant change in terms of the political discourse we have here in the country.
Thanks very much for the call. What about Iran? Is that going? Is policy there going to be a growing issue in this campaign?
Iran is, yes, it is. Iran is one of these questions that you watch both Democrats and Republicans try to figure out how to handle because of the engagement in Iraq. What has that done in terms of potentially limiting some of our policy options and what we might do in terms of Iran, and I think the evolution of that of those policies within each individual candidate and within the parties is pretty critical in terms of what's the next step in terms of fighting this war on terror. And I don't think that you've seen clear directions. I think you've seen sort of generalized approaches, but I don't think you've seen any specific policy suggestions at this point.
Yeah. A little time left, but enough for you to comment. Alan from Delavan. Sorry, we're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. And good morning. I was wondering, you know, with Senator Clinton's proposal on $5,000 for each child born. Isn't that kind of like pandering to the voters? It just sounds like 40 acres and a mule revisited. I mean, what's going on here with that?
That's just her concept of if you have $5,000, and assuming that what she means by that is you hold that you can't touch that until you retire, that creates over time because of interest and compound interest that you have a sizable retirement. Having said that, it was kind of out of the blue, kind of a proposal that sort of out of nowhere, but we'll see how it sort of plays out with the Democratic electorate.
David, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
David Winston, always a pleasure to speak with him, our All Things Political guest this hour. He is president of the Winston Group, and he's done a whole lot of political work for a number of years in Washington. This group is a survey research firm. David is president and founder of the organization. He's done a lot of work with political campaigns, has served as senior leadership staff in Washington, and as a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for answering the phone calls this hour, and thanks for calling us, everybody. This is a regular feature Mondays at 9. We talk politics. News ahead will return on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.